acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 88, Approximation and Poetry. Monday, August 31st, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. This week, I'd like to give a special shout out to Knitting Daddy, who reported that he is going to back episodes of Yarns at Yin Hu and listening through to the present day. It's been a kind of a busy week around Yin Hu. I was able to get a lot of projects done that I've been procrastinating about until the end of the summer, and I also did something that I've been wanting to do all summer long, and that is taking a rather long walk on a trail near my home called the McDade Trail. It's about 30 miles or so and stretches from Shawnee to Dingman's Ferry. It winds its way along the Delaware River, and there's some beautiful grassland as well as river views and incredible wooded sections. I was able to complete about 12 and a half miles of this trail in an afternoon. It was a very quiet weekday afternoon, not too hot, a little bit of a breeze in the air, and a little bit of autumn in the air as well. And it was a great chance for some introspection and forward planning and just quiet thinking. When you work in the school system, the new year of January 1st really doesn't feel like so much of a new year. The new year for me is always September and the start of the new school year. I don't think there are many professions where you get to have such a fresh start every year as you do when you work in education. New students, new curriculum, changes, planning, and even for those who claim that they're not very excited about their educations, there is kind of this overwhelming sense of anticipation at the beginning of the academic year. So more, even more sometimes than in January, I find myself pensive and reflective near the end of August, thinking about the new year ahead and what it brings. The cover photograph for this episode is from my walk. There is a really neat elevated boardwalk on part of the trail, and it overlooks this desolate, swampy area with a few snags. I think that's what you call a standing dead tree. And there are also lots of cattails and different kinds of grasses. I thought that was a good panorama for the cover photo and reflective of my mood at this time of year. Today's episode features the following segments: the front porch, the back porch, ever-expanding skill set, and off the shelf. The front porch. This week, I worked on a new-to-me cast-on method called the long-tail tubular cast-on. I watched a very helpful video done by Isolde Teague learning how to do this cast-on method, and then I thought I would learn it much better by repeating the process on a series of very small projects rather than a more in-depth project. So over the course of the week, I knit 4 or 5 Angel Babies hats. This is a really adorable pattern by Angelia Magara for a little stockinette cap with an I-cord top that you tie into a little knot. So it's a little beanie style cap. And I've been knitting with 50% purple yarn so that these little caps can be donated to Click for Babies. Each year that I've been facilitating a little knit and crochet club called String Theory at the school where I work, we have participated in a Click for Babies hat donation. And the students in the club knit or crochet hats, and I also ask colleagues for donations. So over the course of the year, I try to complete quite a few of these, and I've always just used a regular long tail cast on method for the ribbing on the hat. But this week, I worked on using the long tail tubular cast on and then doing 1x1 rib and 2x2 rib according to Isolde Teague's directions. This is a little bit tedious and tricky, but it just looks like such a polished, nicely finished edging for a hat. And I could see where this would look nice on sleeve cuffs, at the bottom of a sweater. It might be a little more challenging to manipulate the number of stitches you need for the bottom of a sweater. But nevertheless, I think it would be a really nice technique to use. And it's incredibly stretchy as well. I had my doubts as I was completing it. I thought, this cast on is so tight. How could it result in a stretchy edge? But it does. So after completing a series of the little Angel Babies hats, I turned to a Christmas knitting project. I was really taken by a pattern called Rhode Island Red. It's by Pam Sluter. It's a free pattern available in the early fall edition of Knitty, the 2015 early fall edition of Knitty. It calls for DK weight yarn in 2 different colors and US size 5. Needles. The pattern is called Rhode Island Red, and it has a chicken on the hat, actually a series of chickens done in stranded knitting. I have a few particular chicken lovers on my Christmas list, and I thought I would try this hat for one of those recipients. The edge of the hat is actually knit and then folded and bound together with a 3-needle. Is it a 3-needle bind off? Yeah, you do a provisional cast on, and then you knit in the main color, then the contrasting color, start your stranded knitting, and then unpick the provisional cast on and knit those 2 layers together so that the band of the hat is a double thickness. I tried that method. I cast on, I completed about 25 or so rows of the pattern, and I found that that double thickness made the hat really too tight. And I didn't like the way the rest of the hat started to look in contrast to that double thickness. So I turned to this idea of a tubular cast on to replace the border of this hat. And I'm pretty pleased with the result. So I cast on in the contrasting color. I did a tubular cast on. I did not switch it to a 2x2 rib. I just kept it a 1x1 rib. And then after the brim or border of the hat, then I started knitting the chart for the stranded knitting portion of the hat. So far, I really like the way it's coming out. I have opted to knit the largest size after reading some of the reviews that the hat came out a little bit smaller than expected. And I'm working on catching my floats so that the inside of the hat is as neat and tidy as possible. I'm not a very experienced stranded knitter, so I'm not expecting perfection on that front, but I do hope that this hat turns out as charming as it looks in the photos. I did print out the chart and then altered the shape of the chicken a little bit to make it more plump. I think the chicken that's featured in the chart is a little bit of a scrawny chicken, and I wanted a really robust Rhode Island red. So I colored in a few additional boxes of the chart, and we'll see how it turns out. Hopefully it still looks like a chicken. The back porch. This week I completed the weaving project that I had begun on my Cricut loom. It's a loom I purchased with grant money to work on fiber arts with students at the school where I work. And my intention was to figure out how to warp the loom so that I could show students how to do it. Thanks to Emily of the Fibertown podcast, I was able to purchase a Craftsy video, and it has a tutorial, a very helpful tutorial for warping the loom. Also included in the materials for this class is a worksheet to figure out yardage needed for both the warp and weft, depending on the length and the width of the fabric that you want. I anticipate that students will want to make a scarf, but I'm not certain about that. So I think that using this worksheet for the math will help them work out what they have yarn enough to do and how to proceed with their weaving. I was very pleased with the Cricut loom and how easy it was to complete the project once I had the loom warped. As I mentioned in the last episode, I think it was the last episode, I prefer to do hem stitching for both the beginning and ending borders of a woven project. I think it has a very tidy look, and I think it's a great way to have the project in good shape to cut off the loom and not worry about what's happening at the very beginning of the project. I complete the hem stitch at the beginning of the weaving before I start rolling the fabric onto the cloth beam. And then at the end, when I'm done with weaving, all I have to do is that second round of hem stitch at the end of the project. This also makes it easy to complete multiple projects with the same warp. And that's something I'm considering maybe for holiday gifts in the future. I was thinking about not necessarily a table runner, but a sort of oversized placemat that could be a good centerpiece for a table, or it could be a nice covering for the top of a dresser. And it would really show off some handspun or maybe some unconventional uses of yarn to weave a rather small piece. And in the case of doing several of them for gifts, I could just warp the loom with quite a long extent of warping thread and then weave several projects and use the hem stitch to tie each one off, then advance the loom and start another project and maybe fit three or four of those and only have to warp the loom one time. So all of this is occurring to me as I'm learning a little bit more about how to use the loom, and I'm excited for the possibilities for my students in the future. The second thing I completed this week was a second entry into the Asymmetrical. If you've been thinking about entering this craft along, there is still one entire month to participate. The Asymmetrical is an asymmetrical craft along. You can crochet, you can knit, you can sew, you can even enter woven accessories or garments. And the only stipulation is that they are asymmetrical in some way. It could be design, it could be construction, it could even be a symmetrical pattern, but in some way you use asymmetrical color in the project. There are all levels of asymmetry, from the very subtle to the incredibly dramatic. And one thing about asymmetrical garments and accessories is the way that they tend to lend drama to your look, because they draw the eye up and away. And this can be beneficial for several reasons. They can draw the eye to your face, which is always striking and dramatic because your face is the most exciting and interesting part of you. They can also be slimming because they detract from the actual width of your measurements. And by drawing the eye up and away, they give a slenderizing appeal to your figure. And this could be hemlines, this could be asymmetrical lines of a top, this could be asymmetrical lines of a shawl. It could even be the asymmetry of wearing things that are mismatched. So there are all different kinds of ways to play with this asymmetry. On the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry, there are two threads, one with information about the craft along and chatter about projects, and another for finished object photo posts. There are a number of prizes that I will award at the conclusion of the Asymmetrical. It concludes at the end of September, and I'll be announcing prize winners at the beginning of October. So plenty of time to join in. Lots of folks have posted ideas for patterns. And in addition to completing the folded lace tank by Bristol Ivy, I've also knit dotted rays by Stephen West. This pattern is very interesting because the overall shape of the shawl is only slightly asymmetrical. So it's a crescent-shaped shawl, and if I fold it in half, it's not completely symmetrical, but it's not way off either. It gives the appearance of being quite symmetrical in shape, but it's asymmetrical in its design and construction. I think the pattern has a lot of opportunity to play and experiment. That's kind of a hallmark of Stephen West patterns, and that's why I enjoy knitting his design so much. In this case, I have opted to use a commercially spun hand-dyed yarn as well as some hand-spun yarn. There are short rows in the pattern, and for the short row sections, I've used this beautiful aqua blue hand-dyed yarn in the colorway High Tide. This is all fingering weight yarn and knit on US size 6 needles. And then in the pattern, there are occasional, or they're not exactly sporadic because they're regularly placed, but some lines of the written pattern are numbered. And those lines of the pattern I knit with some hand-spun batlings from Hobbledehoy in a host of blues and greens and purples. So the whole thing has this sort of aquatic feel to it. It's a lovely drapey garter stitch shawl, and it is, to my extreme pleasure, quite a big shawl. So with a nearly 500 yard skein of yarn and then about 300 or 400 yards of the hand spun, this has turned into quite a generously sized shawl. It may not, however, be my shawl because I received a request for a shawl from a family member who knows someone who is recently diagnosed with cancer and asked about shawls that I might have on hand and something that could be used as a gift. So she hasn't made her selection yet of a gift she would like to give, but I think I will put this dotted raised shawl among the possibilities for selection because I think it would make a really nice, comfortable, and soft shawl for this purpose. So we'll see. I think another dotted raise shawl is definitely in my future. I have a tradition of completing a project with scrap yarn around the new year, and I think this would also be a great candidate for using up leftover fingering weight yarn from other projects. I've seen quite a few of those posted on Ravelry, one in particular that was at the top of page 7 on the 5K finish line for Stash Dash. Just every time got my attention and I kept looking at it and examining the color choices, and it just seems like there's not a way to do this shawl wrong. Any way you knit it, it will come out gorgeous. Ever expanding skill set. This weekend, Samuel and I did some entertaining at Yinhu, and because I'm fearless, that is always my opportunity to work on some new recipes. I usually try to have a few tried and true things, but I always feel motivated when I entertain to try something new, even though, of course, there's no assurance that it's going to work out. So something tried and true that I've been doing all summer is to add cooked grains to green salads. It's just some added fiber and protein, and a little bit goes a long way in salads so that I can keep adding it to different salads over the course of a week. In this case, I had some fresh ingredients from the farmer's market. I had some of that frozen roasted corn that I thawed and added to a salad, and then I add some cooked quinoa and toss the salad. And my guests remarked about that they were wondering what it was, and it looked like seeds or maybe ground nuts or something. But then I said, oh, it's quinoa. I've been adding green to salads, and made a homemade salad dressing, and the salad went over quite well. So that was the tried and true. And then the new item is something that I've been hoping to grill all summer, but waiting for a crowd to assemble, because Samuel and I don't eat a great deal of red meat. So usually I like to have those things when we're having company. The recipe is called Meat Bacon. It is from a cookbook called Where There's Smoke by Barton Seaver, And it's a recipe that takes a great deal of dedication and commitment. It's also something of a spectacle for guests. It involves turning a New York strip steak into something with maybe not so much a texture, but definitely a flavor that resembles bacon. And I've had this, but I've never prepared it. So the gift was from my sister and brother-in-law, the gift of this cookbook, plus all of the ingredients to make this dish, which are a New York strip steak and about a cup of red wine and a cup of a very high quality soy sauce. The soy sauce and red wine mixture are used as a marinade, and you dip this steak into the marinade and put it back on the grill every 45 seconds to 1 minute. It turns your deck or porch or yard into such a smoke scene that I was thinking any minute one of the neighbors was going to call the fire department on us. But boy, is it delicious. I put the strip steaks out to rest, and then I was in the kitchen doing something while Samuel was slicing them very, very thinly for everyone to eat. And when I got back out, there was barely enough left for me to snap a photo of it. So I highly recommend this recipe and The Great Ideas in Where There's Smoke by Barton Seaver. During the month of September for hashtag Power Pantry, I'd like to explore pantry ideas suitable for the lunchbox. It's back to work time for me, and that means taking my lunch to work. I can often fall into the pit of being uninspired, unmotivated. Either I pack the same lunch for so many days that I start to get bored, or I get so lazy that I don't bring my lunch, and then I'm really at the mercy of snap decisions, unhealthy choices, and coin-operated machines at the workplace. So I would like to know your tips and strategies for packing satisfying meals for lunch. What do you stock in your pantry? Do you take leftovers? Do you reimagine leftovers? Are there particular things that are special just for lunch? Do you keep a pantry of any kind in your office, or maybe in your automobile, or maybe in your handbag? Do you have a pantry in your handbag? Are there certain things you rely on? Are there recipes that you can recommend? I would like to know about your pantry to lunchbox. And this could be, you know, because you go to work every day, or even lunchbox in terms of taking lunch on the road for a picnic or an outing. I like to do some picnicking well into fall and having special foods for those events, you know, is really an important part of a day trip. Also, how do you pack your lunch? What kind of a bag or receptacle or lunchbox do you have? I've always been fascinated by tiffin boxes, those towering, stackable lunchboxes that are so popular for lunch in India. I've never owned one of them, but I've always fantasized about having one. I look forward to your recipes, tips, suggestions, and photos. We're exploring the lunchbox for September in hashtag Power Pantry. Off the shelf. This week concludes our read-along of Color, A Natural History of the Palette by Victoria Finlay. It's been incredibly illuminating taking a look at dyes and pigments from such a historical and global perspective as Victoria Finlay undertakes to do with this work. Her writing is very appealing. She has a great sense of adventure, and the book is incredibly well researched. I learned a lot, and I was also able to fit new information into the context of things I did know in terms of geography and also some of the things that I've been picking up about color and natural dyeing through my sheep to shawl class. I've been inspired to try some natural dyeing of my own this summer as a result of my reading, and most recently I've begun to harvest some of my indigo. There are several methods for using indigo to dye in wild color. That seems to be the reference guide that we're using for the sheep to shawl class. And I was a little mystified about exactly which method to choose. So I tried one method with a small handful of leaves. I knew this wouldn't make a great deal of dye, so I kept my quantities very small. I just wanted to see if I could get it to turn blue, and I couldn't. I suspect we'll be using a fermentation method in the class, and I think I will wait to harvest any more leaves until I have a little bit more information about methods and which methods work. I have been pinching back the flowers on my indigo plants, doing a lot of watering since we're experiencing something of a dry spell here in the Northeast. I've been adding compost and watering the indigo to keep it as lush and full as possible. And I learned that you can pinch off leaves, and new leaves will take off on the stems. So I tried pinching off a few leaves, and I'm watching the progress of the regrowth and looking very much forward to the September installment of the Sheep to Shawl class coming up in a few weekends. I did do some additional research in the variety of indigo that I'm growing. It's Japanese indigo, also known as Japanese knotweed, I believe. And it resembles the basil plant somewhat in the shape of the leaf. It's a somewhat rounded leaf and sort of a low-growing, bushy kind of plant. I may try to bring one of the healthier plants indoors for the winter time and get some seeds from that plant that I can dry and attempt to germinate again in the spring. I don't think that this climate in eastern Pennsylvania will result in reseeding, a natural reseeding of the plant in the spring. I think it's something that you have to work on over the course of the winter and the early spring to save seeds and germinate. And I've also read that the seeds don't last more than one season. So it really needs to be an ongoing process if you want to keep harvesting your own indigo plants. In the final chapter, Violet, Victoria Finlay really turns her writing on high gear because her search to understand the deep purple color takes her to several different parts of the globe on an incredible adventure and ties together a lot of other information about blue and indigo as well. I really enjoyed reading that chapter and then reading her conclusion as well. And I wanted to share a little excerpt from the conclusion because she talks about Pantone and the Pantone palette of colors. In the natural world, where the color of an ochre might depend on the exact place where it was mined, or where an indigo dye could be dozens of different shades depending on the dipping time, the alkalinity, and even the sunniness of the day, making colors has traditionally been an imprecise, although often highly symbolic, activity. But at Pantone, which has grown to be the biggest color specification company in the world, color is all about precision. Herbert, and by Herbert, she's referring to Lawrence Herbert, who is sometimes called the Color King. Herbert and his colleagues started by dividing the world into 15 basic colors, including black and white, making up about 1,000 shades. He later introduced even more elaborate systems, including colors with evocative names like wood violet, moss tone, sulfur spring, and doe. Pantone sells the basic catalog in fan-like books, and if you have one and your contact has one, then you can both know exactly what shade you are talking about. It started off as a service for printers, but the expanded system has proved to have a myriad of uses. Pantone color standards have been used for renovating the tiles in the mosaics of San Marco in Venice, for giving official definitions of the colors used in national flags, and for measuring the color, and therefore sometimes the quality, of gemstones. But one of the company's proudest innovations does not have to do with art or heraldry or jewelry, but with medicine. We've just developed cards that can identify the fat content of a liver by color prior to a transplant, Herbert told me. The cards have already saved lives by cutting down on rejection rates. Previously, measuring color was based more on art than on science. Now we can be exact. And then she goes on to discuss Herbert's plans for Pantone in the future. "We won't do names anymore," he said. "In the next round, we're eliminating them." I felt a little like John Keats, appalled at Newton's audacity in taking the magic out of the rainbow. "But the names of colors are history," I said, thinking of how mummy brown and ultramarine and Scheele's green and Turner's yellow and so many color names hold entire histories of deceit and adventure and experimentation in their syllables. "But we are dealing with science and measurement," he explained patiently. "This is a digital world now, and computers don't need names, they need numbers. People talk about barn red, but they never saw a Scandinavian barn in their life. And what does lipstick red mean anyway? Today we can have our houses and our cars and our clothes any color we like, without reference to nature or to anything more symbolic than the fashion world's decision about what colors are right for the next season. And so perhaps it is not strange that we do not seem to need or even want to be reminded of their history anymore." I could understand what Herbert was saying. He needed to adapt to new demands from the computer and internet market. But I was relieved that I had encountered him toward the end of my research, and I felt glad that I had made my paint box journeys when I could still explore worlds of approximation and poetry before the colors began to lose their words. I think the parting wisdom I've gathered from this summer reading is an understanding of the appeal and also the division between colors of the natural world and synthetically developed colors. It's not easy to take a stand because I can certainly see the appeal of science. When he talked about those color cards to identify the fat content of a liver before transplant, I thought, wow, you know, that's not really a time that you want to have color words. You want to have numbers. You want to have assurance that you have a match or a near match. That's the science of color. But I guess the poet in me likes the language of color and the idea that color words mean different things at different times, and they have the ability to sway people and change attitudes. Once I moved into a home where the room I was intending to use as my office was this putrid, orangey, yellow color, and I just kept thinking of like baby poo, and it was just an unappealing color, until one of my guests entered and said, "Oh, pumpkin." And it totally revolutionized my feeling about the color in the room. And I stopped wanting to repaint it and just embraced the color. I was also swayed in doing some renovation at Yin Hu. We were looking for a trim color, and I was just completely taken in by the color name mink. To me, it just felt so deep and luxurious and rich. And I just couldn't consider any other color. It had to be mink. We had to paint it mink. I can also see historically the incredible appeal of synthetic color when it came to be available, and how important that was for industrialization and marketing to be able to have consistency and reassurance that your dyeing process would yield a certain outcome. But I guess now that we have such incredible access to synthetic color, the mystery and guesswork and the appeal of natural dyeing has also become more alluring. And to see subtlety in color is also very important. The teachers of my sheep to shawl class were remarking, and I hope that we are able to talk about this in more depth in our upcoming classes. They talked about Rudolf Steiner, who is the originator of this Waldorf system of education, and his notion that the bright, almost garish synthetic colors that are prevalent in the world of young people especially are really dulling their sensitivity to the colors of the natural world and being able to detect subtlety. And he made some kind of a connection between the ability of a person to detect nuances in color and the ability of that same person to detect other kinds of nuance and subtlety, things that may not be so literal. I think that's an interesting concept and something I would like to explore in greater depth in the future. Thanks to everyone who has been a participant in the read along. I've learned a lot. I've enjoyed hearing from those who have posted on the board. And I'm interested in other ideas for read along texts. I think it would be nice to have a read along in the winter and one in the summer as a way of maybe expanding the typical kinds of reading that we do and of having an audience of or a group of like-minded people to consider topics with maybe a little more thoroughness than if we're just reading on our own.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves are down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stone to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is So Wheat. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Nature's ever get you high till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.